heroes walk among us. They are in our midst every day. At Heroes in Our Midst, we find them, we celebrate them, and we learn from them. Heroes in Our Midst is a podcast about the power inside the heart, the human behind the story, and the collection of idiosyncrasies that both make us unique and bond us together through a common humanity. Join us as we are inspired, as we learn, and as we are challenged to be better by the heroes in our midst and the stories that they tell. Hey, thanks for joining me. I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Koop, and this is Heroes in Our Midst. Every week, I have the opportunity to share a story of great accomplishment, yes, but I'm not only looking for the shiny stuff. I want you to know what truly makes them a hero, the inside, and what it was really like. Chantel Givens is a paratriathlete. She was born with only one hand. She joined the National Paratriathlon Program in 2012 when she won the national championships, and only 4 years later, qualified and competed at the 2016 Paralympic Games in Rio. Now, she's a mom, a teacher, a coach, and she seems to balance it all. It was a beautiful, breezy summer day when I stopped by to see Chantel. So we sat out on her deck. So, as you hear her story, you'll also hear planes, trains, and automobiles. Consider it the perfect background to a journey that literally included miles and miles to complete. Of course, it had to start somewhere. Chantel?
I would say, as a kid, I was active. I liked trying things, but I'd say it probably does have more of a factor in where I got to now, because my parents really had an attitude of just treat me like a regular kid. And I know that when I was born, one of the doctors even said I might not sit because I'd be off balance. And I only have one hand, nothing else. But I think that attitude early on of, well, if people think I can't do it, I'll just prove to them I can, came to me very early on. So I have to give credit to my parents for just treating me like a kid, teaching me how to tie my laces, mowing the lawn, and just doing different recreational activities. So I would say my start on the mental side came from there, definitely.
Yeah. So already you weren't given excuses and you weren't given an out just because something might have been a little different than a lot of other kids. So did they put you into other sports? Did you try a lot of things?
I did. When I was young, I tried anything from soccer, gymnastics, taekwondo, downhill skiing, and softball. It was kind of whatever I wanted to try, I tried. And I started fairly late for that sport, but I got into springboard diving and tried it the very first time on a dare because I was at the public pool with a kid from my class and he could do somersaults and I couldn't. So I wanted to learn. But once I got started, I really saw the competitive side, and that's not something that competitive sports wasn't something in my family's background. So I really learned that from diving, and I ended up competing for 10 years.
Wow. So 10 years in diving, and did the fact that you had one hand affect that at all in terms of how you dove and what you had to do to train?
Well, it definitely affected how I dove, and it took me a few years to understand that. And you can definitely see at 14, I wasn't looking for a para sport option. I just wanted to be with the other kids. But if you think of a sport like diving, other than one hand, there's really not many disabilities that would make you physically capable of competing or diving.
Yeah.
So there's no para diving events. It doesn't exist. But definitely my entries weren't as clean.
Sure.
And for grabbing, like, I had to be more careful with, not carrying extra belly weight. I would use sticky tape on my leg to help grab.
Oh, yeah.
Because little things like that. I really enjoyed platform diving, which is higher, but I quickly learned that probably wasn't smart because not having the same solid base of support.
Right.
You hit the water at 60 to 80 K an hour when you're up there. And I ripped my eardrum once when I missed my hands. But I still, when I was young, I had a dream of the Sydney 2000 Olympics. And eventually I got realistic and I made nationals. And that wasn't para, so it's kind of like a top 40. And then I retired and I was happy with that.
Okay.
So that's really where my competitive experience started.
So now how old were you at this point?
I started at 14, which for a diver is super old. Most people start quite a bit younger, or they come from gymnastics at that age and they already have that kinesthetic awareness and they just have to learn how to go from foot to head.
Right.
The mechanics are different, but it's still a smoother transition than coming from something like skiing where you're just on your feet all the time.
Right, right. So diving was done for you. You weren't done competing though. So where did that lead you next?
Well, I knew when I was in university, I was still diving, and I knew that at some point it would come to an end.
Okay.
And there was one summer, it was probably a year or two before I finished diving, there was a World Triathlon Championship. I grew up in Edmonton.
Okay.
And it was taking place in Edmonton, and they'd actually contacted our diving team to help volunteer at the event.
Oh.
And I ended up handing water bottles at the finish line to Simon Whitfield, who had been Olympic champion.
Wow.
So in the back of my mind, that was what I wanted to do next.
Cool.
So I waited. I took a break. My body needed a break after diving. And then I got into triathlon and was actually pretty disheartened at first, mm-hmm. because I trained pretty hard. And I did get a spot at World Championships for athlete with a disability.
Okay.
But there were so many categories, I just competed against myself. And we were treated as second rate. They didn't even put the timing mats in properly, so I didn't get split times. They changed the course 2 days before the event because it was hilly and they didn't think the wheelchairs would get up. So after that, I thought, able-bodied, I'm a slow swimmer, I'm missing a paddle relative to other people. So I kind of ventured away, went back to school to get my education degree and got more into the running side and did cross country and mm-hmm. ran a few marathons. And then just as I was stepping away from triathlon, I met who's now my husband, and he was just trying them. So I did an event thinking, oh, I'm not trained for triathlon, because he was doing it. And mm-hmm. when I was there, the executive director of Triathlon Manitoba at the time approached me after the event and told me that it had just been announced that triathlon would become a Paralympic sport. Was I interested? And I'll be honest, at the time I said no. It was 2012. I had just run Boston. My dad had just passed away. I was burnt out.
Right.
But then I started thinking about it, and the event, the Para Triathlon Championship, was in Edmonton, and it was in July once teaching was done. So at the last, actually 3 days before, I decided, you know what, I'm gonna drive out, see mom, and do the race.
Wow.
And I ended up winning in a sprint finish.
Oh my goodness.
And that's where everything kind of changed. And you know, it took a few months to get sorted out, but I was approached by the Canadian Sports Center. I met Adrian, I met Daryl, I met Gary, and I had a few months to kind of think about what I wanted to commit to, and then it kind of went from there.
Wow. So now you skimmed over a little bit that you ran Boston. You can't run Boston if you don't run a certain time. Isn't that correct? So obviously,
yes.
you obviously were a pretty darn good runner already then. So you had a good start at this whole triathlon thing.
I did. I'd say, thinking that I'm coming from diving, I would have thought the swimming would be easier, but the running's really where my strong suit is.
Okay.
And the interesting thing is, when I started, running's the last part, because you swim, then you bike, then you run. And my biking was pretty weak, to be honest.
Okay.
And that took a lot of work. And then later on, it also took doing a lot of bike modifications, because I didn't have leverage with my hand.
Right.
And that actually affects your power a lot more than you would think.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'd had some little sockets made just to support my mm-hmm. arm, but we eventually switched to a ring concept because okay. I have a bit of a wrist.
Yeah.
So being able to grab and get leverage, but also be able to get down into an arrow position, mm-hmm. which my initial one, my arm would be sticking up if I tried to go down.
Yeah.
That made a big difference for the bike. The part that evolved a lot is when a sport becomes a Paralympic sport for the first time, your field changes every year significantly. Your competitive field. Whereas at first, it was something I could just run people down, because
right.
that was at the end. But then you get these former like medalists in the Paralympics from swimming coming in, and you know, they're 2-3 minutes faster than me coming out of the water. Right. And then it becomes not just a fitness thing to try to run them down, because everybody's improving. Yeah. And another side that probably people do not realize that's different from an Olympic side to a Paralympic side is that there's the whole disability category
right.
factor.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to try to make it fair, but competitive. What that meant is there were a lot of changes. You have to get classified for a specific category.
Okay.
Whereas in 2013, I raced at World Championships, came fourth in upper body impairments. In 2014, I raced World Championships and came fourth in a category that was least disabled. So now, people who are missing more of an arm are in a more disabled category.
Mm.
People with one foot are racing against me. And they get to run with a blade, but we can't wear a paddle in the water.
Right.
So sometimes your former roommate is now your competitor. Like, those changes made it difficult, so you couldn't just look at the placements to see where you would be.
Yeah.
And because they wanted to keep it competitive, qualifying didn't mean being top in Canada. It meant being ranked to be guaranteed a spot top 7 in the world.
Wow.
So it's a small field, but they wanted to maintain the competitive aspect of it.
Right.
So that was some of the challenges going through, whereas a fourth place and a fourth place really didn't mean the same thing at all.
Yeah. Incredible. It is such a difference than when you talk about, if we're just talking triathlon and everyone's pretty much the same, able-bodied, right? They just
yeah.
go and it's the time. But was that frustrating for you? Was that a frustrating part of it? Were there things that were done that you felt were unfair? What were some of the challenges that were even mentally in trying to compete in the Paralympic or para-triathlon?
I would definitely say there were frustrations with mm-hmm. that, especially when you don't know what's going to happen and they change them. And since Rio, to be honest, I wasn't quite ready to close the door right away, but then they've changed the classification yet again. And sometimes it's going through all the assessments, the medical assessments. You have to travel because only certain races evaluate you. I'm sure that for other people, there was another Canadian girl who had MS. And when they changed the categories, she was put kind of on hold. So she ended up leaving paratriathlon entirely because her condition fluctuates. So
right.
they would assess her before every race.
Right.
And like this lady was a phenomenal runner, but it depended on the conditions.
Right.
So sometimes she could run like an 18-minute 5K, which is faster than anybody in my event at the end of a triathlon
mm-hmm.
could do. But if the water conditions were not good and her condition wasn't well, then she was disabled.
Right.
So from the perspective of someone racing against her, sometimes you feel like, well, I'm just racing against an able-bodied athlete. So to take that out, but then how can she plan an entire season to not even know if she's gonna race, because she can't control what her condition's gonna do?
Yeah.
So it did kind of push certain people out.
Mm-hmm.
But for myself, my condition's stable, it doesn't change.
Yeah.
So it was just dealing with what there was and making the most of my strengths.
Yeah. Another incredible example of doing something with what you can control and letting the uncontrollables take care of themselves, which is why you made it so far. Now we know you did make it to the 2016 Olympics. Take us
mm-hmm.
through the qualification process for you, sort of from that 2012 leading into 2016. When did you know and how did you get there?
Well, when I actually knew was not long before the games, I will be honest. The criteria weren't even established in 2013, so I raced.
Wow.
World Championships were in London. I came fourth, so things looked pretty good. Then 2014, they were in Edmonton. I came fourth again,
mm-hmm.
and the categories were different, so things looked reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But just to show how things fluctuate, my first big frustration happened after those games, because I actually lost my Sport Canada carding I came fourth at World Championships, but my time was 6% slower than the winners, and their criteria was 5%. So then I was being asked to do more, and at the same time, I'm teaching full-time, and I have stepkids that I help with driving, I have a dog, I have a husband, and they were asking me to do more with less.
Wow.
So that ended up getting sorted out, and I did get my funding back.
Okay.
And I reduced my teaching load to about 70%. Kept racing. Then I had the actual qualification was a 1 year time period.
Okay.
And it's not a one race, it's a ranking system, and they count your top three races. And then different races had different tiers, so they were worth different amounts of points. So okay. Essentially, you had to do World Championships because they were three times the points, your Continental Championships, and then your best of other races. And qualification started. I did an event in Detroit. I didn't feel well. I didn't have a great race. And when I got home, I was getting ready for a race in Edmonton where prospects were really good. And then there was World Championships in Chicago, and I was kind of mad at myself, and I went hard on the bike, fell, broke my shoulder blade as soon as qualification started.
Wow.
So by this point, I'd actually taken a partial leave of absence from work. So I'm only getting one class a day. So that's like 20 some percent of my salary.
Mm-hmm.
So my family, things that went through my head when this happened, because the racing criteria, I had doctors telling me 6 weeks to recover, and it was the shoulder blade on my side with a hand.
Oh.
So I went from being upset of racing to not being able to brush my hair or wipe myself when I went to the bathroom.
Wow.
And doctors said 6 weeks, World Championships were in five. And so Edmonton was out of the picture, and it ended up sending me to Australia several months later. So I did get positives. I had different experiences. But I ended up getting in the water and being able to swim just a few days before Worlds. And I made it. I came eighth. I believe it was seventh or eighth, which was the lowest spot that still kept me in the running. I did what I had to do.
Were you in pain? Were you in serious pain? This is really unbelievable. Like you were just days after what they said, and then that doesn't necessarily mean you're 100%, like when they give you those predictions.
No, and I definitely wasn't. After it happened, I had a couple of days where I didn't feel so good, and then I thought, okay, this isn't going to change, so what can I do to maximize recovery? And I worked with, my team was phenomenal. We started doing like bike workouts. It was beautiful outside, but indoors, my arm was strapped up, just getting the legs to move.
Yep.
But that's where I learned, even if I can't sleep because it hurts, I was in bed for 8.5 hours a day. At least it was summer. Yep. So I really just focused on that. Eating well.
Wow.
You know, I was never a big drinker, but the occasional glass of wine out the window, because I was thinking if something can delay my recovery by an hour, I might need that hour.
Look at you.
So
yeah,
one of the things that actually helped a lot, and I don't know if you only cover athletes, but in that time I met Maria Matusis.
Okay.
Who was a lawyer who had just lost her hand in an explosion.
Wow.
And when I met her, I had just broken my shoulder blade, and she had such a positive outlook. And she had a few different questions. We're actually good friends now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helped me look at the positive side, because when I'd start kind of stressing, I'd be thinking, okay, mine's not gone. It's going to get better.
Yeah.
And that was a big game changer for me. And then when I got to the start line, I knew I wasn't able to go 100% in the swim, which was already my weakest. Luckily, the water was cold. And that helped.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little bit kind of like ice. And then I was a little hesitant on the bike as well, because I knew if I fell, it would be very serious. And they'd had a flash flood the night before, of course. Like, the phone alert wakes everybody up at 1 a.m. The race is at 6 something a.m. They delayed it by 45 minutes to clean the roads. but I was a little hesitant. So a lot of that was just focusing on the process and the task at hand. And then when I got to the run, I just ran as hard as I could. And from there, I was still in the running. Uh-huh. So then it was really just buckling down, and it wasn't just showing up at training.
Yeah.
And then to qualify, I ended up going to Australia, not performing well enough, and then going to Spain 3 weeks later, which wasn't planned. And I won that race. So I didn't find out until July of 2016 for sure that I had a spot. But when I won that race in May, we kind of knew that my ranking would be such that it would be difficult for me not to be selected, but it was still a possibility.
Can you even take us a little bit? We're going to go back a little bit. So now you've
sure.
qualified, but we're going to go back a little bit because I want you to tell us what, so you're doing all this training, and you talked about your stepkids, you talked about life and jobs, and what was a day like for you? When in the world did you get training in? Some of us are just trying to stay fit and we can't get it in. Could you remember those days? You must remember those days, unless they were so hard. Maybe you've blocked them from your memory, but maybe take us there so that we hear that part, even though this race, the story of this race is really incredible enough that you overcame that.
Well, the funny thing is the way that we actually worked, and sometimes the scheduling was the hardest part, but at Canadian Sports Center, Daryl put together a spreadsheet, and I blacked out when I was working, when I was picking up kids, and then the other trainers had access. It was in Dropbox, and they would put in my workouts. So it was there, and it just became my job. And I looked at that. I like check marks, so I would take that out and I would write on a little sticky note on the fridge, and every little thing that I did, I would check off. And like Tuesdays were always probably my busiest day with the kids. So that was when typically my hardest workout was put in.
Okay.
So it was short, but it was hard. So it was just kind of working around that. And I didn't have time. Like now as a mom, I look, some people talk about postpartum depression, and we had so many things going on. I didn't have time to reflect and think about how hard that is. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest now, I don't know how I did those bike workouts because I have my bike, and just doing an easy bike seems, my body feels it's hard. So it was all there, and that was my job, and that's how I looked at it.
Amazing. And you know, I think that's great advice for some people. You know, don't think too much about it. If you have this goal, write down your to-do list, and just like anything that you're going to do, check off the boxes. Well, yeah. Chantel, you did that. Now you were ready to head to the Paralympics 2016 Rio. What was that like? What was your Olympic experience? And what did you expect going in?
Well, again, that time became a little bit uncertain, and I really feel for the athletes that were preparing for Tokyo, and now it's delayed because a lot of things can happen in a year. But if we go back to 2016, there was a Zika scare, and that was going on. The race was in Brazil. That did make a difference in the fact that the national team coach was the one that was going to be going to coach us. But she and I would race together, but she wasn't part of my daily training environment. There was a lot of communication. But Daryl, the sport physiologist that coordinated all my programming, we kind of had that trust and that bond. And because of Zika, Daryl ended up not going, and he was supposed to be the physiologist for the entire team. So in some sense, in that way, I had to deal with a little bit of letdowns and not feeling like I quite fit in, like feeling like that kid entering junior high again. And it took me a little bit of time to get rid of that and start focusing on the positive sides. And, you know, I made it, I've earned my spot, because that's not a way to enter a race. I had to change my game.
Wow.
I know that we had a few talks with Adrian on how to reframe the situation I was in, and that feeling of isolation and focus on the task at hand. And when I look back, my result was a little bit disappointing. I really kind of went through the process. I kind of got it together. I had my race plan, and I had thought of everything that could happen, that I thought could happen, and how I would overcome that. And then it seems like all those things happened during the race. And I came out of the water last, and I'd really worked on not worrying. I knew I was against some very strong swimmers, mm-hmm. but it was in the ocean, it was wavy, and I liked that idea because it can equalize a little bit.
Sure.
And I ended up miss-sighting a buoy a little bit. So I kind of got back, then I get to my bike computer quit working, and we checked it like 5 times and replaced the batteries, so of course. And then after, so about halfway through the race, I just thought, you know what, I'm here. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. I'm racing, my mom's there, my aunt's there, my husband's there. I should just enjoy this.
Yeah.
And as soon as I started enjoying it, let go, I had a really good finish. So,
yeah.
You know, the placement wasn't necessarily where I wanted to be, but I still finished at the point where I think I did the best that I could with what I had on that day.
Yeah.
So I have to be satisfied with that,
mm-hmm.
and kind of be happy with that process. It maybe wasn't the ranking result that I wanted at the end, but I ended up coming 8th out of 11. So I just have to think that's 8th in the world, and
yeah.
all those other people didn't make the race.
Yeah.
And thinking of it that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had that, but then the neat thing was, unlike a tournament such as volleyball, basketball,
mm-hmm.
it's a one-shot deal and you're done. There's no prelims, there's one race and you're done.
Right.
And the nice thing of that was my race was on day 3. So I then had a week to enjoy and go watch some events, meet some amazing athletes, go for runs with other people that were done, and really being inspired by other stories.
Yeah.
Like there was this guy running and cerebral palsy, and he ran the 1500 in like just over 4 minutes. And I was thinking, it really opened my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And being at a para games itself is unbelievable. I actually have top respect for how the Brazilians managed and coped the games.
Yeah.
And I know the media gave a lot of bad press, but imagine having a village, an athlete's village, where everybody's disabled.
Yeah.
You have all these paved paths, but you've got small people on bikes, you have blind people being led by somebody else, you have wheelchairs, you have everybody in the same space at the same time. And just the buses to leave the village, every single bus, there was, I don't remember if it was 30 or 50 stops, just for the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
Every single one had a ramp and 2 volunteers to help put people in. That's the kind of thing that I really learned. It's not the same as having an accessible parking spot. Everybody has a disability. And the way that it was dealt with, just having a Team Canada meeting, you can't leave your room 2 minutes before and expect to get an elevator to get down to the meeting. You have to start half an hour before because everybody's going to be using them. And just meeting other people and their stories really made me feel so fortunate to have had the experience, to have met those people, but just the inspiration. It was a really an unreal experience.
And here we are being inspired by you, and you feel that others inspired you even more.
Yeah.
So Chantel, you had this amazing Paralympic experience in terms of what you just said. So the 2016 games wrap up. And then what's sort of transpired from there? Was that it for you, or do you continue on?
Well, at that point, just to keep in mind, I was 38 when I competed, so
wow.
I felt very fortunate, because when I was that 15, 16-year-old hoping to be an Olympic diver, when I finally kind of get past that point, this opportunity comes up and I can live my childhood dream in a different way. But I wasn't quite ready to shut the door, but I also had, I kind of had two factors. One was looking at my family. I'm 38, so my biological time to become a mother was coming near its end. And I know there was a couple of other girls I was racing against that were planning on having a child, getting right back to training for Tokyo. And I had that at first, a little bit in the back of my mind, but I also had Sport Canada, the Canadian Sports Center's mandate was to get me ready for Rio. Mm. So there was no invitation to continue. I would have had to get myself reclassified and get the results to prove, to re-earn my spot, okay, essentially.
Right.
And it ended up being a situation where I spent 2 years pretty much in limbo, which was kind of tough because the fertility part wasn't working, and I blamed myself for quite a while, thinking, well, maybe I'm too active, and it ended up being a completely different story. But unlike the Olympic gold medalist in Rio, who raced, won, ran her first marathon 3 months later, ran it in a crazy time of like 2:40, got pregnant the next week, had a child 9 months later, and she's now training for running events. But it was hard for me to look at that and then kind of wonder what was going on. And eventually we had to go another route, and when you're in fertility treatments, you're taking growth hormones, so there's the whole doping control side.
Right.
Because I was still being tested up to just over a year after the games.
Wow.
Like a knock on the door at 6:30 in the morning. And when we were going that route, I kind of had to decide, okay, I'm not racing. And it's hard if you're thinking, well, I'll race if I don't get pregnant. But then I'm not training too hard because I want my body to be able to go that
route. Right.
To be able to get pregnant. And it ended up taking us a good couple of years, and my son was born February of 2019, so I'm really happy with that. But I knew at that point that was a month before qualification was starting.
Mm-hmm.
So those that had kids even a year before have time to get back in shape for training.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest, right now, looking at everything that's happened in hindsight, I don't think it would have been in the cards, because that 1 year makes a giant difference. Like, you,
for sure.
And for sacrifices for your family, but even I'm finding how much time that it takes. My family doesn't live here. My husband's family's in England, so it's not like I want to go swimming and mom comes to babysit.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started looking at those things, and after kind of the more you work hard for something, sometimes the more you appreciate it. So just appreciating the time to be able to be a mom and not have it be a training camp has been kind of a nice thing. So I've actually never officially retired, but I haven't been racing either. And I don't feel ready to race.
But Chantel, what you speak of is such a unique female athlete experience. And I think some people listening are going to be like, see, that's something that you can speak of that's pretty unique, obviously unique to females, because we're the ones who carry the children. But really, you're talking about it as a privilege now that you think about it. Yes, you said like you haven't retired and you did have to sacrifice those things maybe in a different way, obviously. What is it? Is it all the adversity that you faced along the way, do you think, that makes you able to really see this amazing silver lining?
I would say in a way, yes. I think part of life too, and I think you nailed it earlier when you said it's important to focus on the things you can control. And I found that was a really big shock at first, thinking in racing and competing, things happen, injuries, accidents. But then it never even occurred to me that things like that could happen in a fertility journey, and that sometimes the harder you work for that, the more it goes against you.
Right.
So it, again, I think it was that the process made me appreciate the finish line more. And don't get me wrong, I'm still doing my best to stay active and just trying to make it in. Nap times are great now. It took us a few months to get there, but I do beach body workouts, and then when it's nice, I get out for runs a few times a week. And I've had a couple of pelvic floor issues and injuries, and those are things that I would not have really counted on if things had worked out right away and I'd gotten pregnant and gone back. Some of these issues would have become major problems if I was trying to race internationally.
Right.
And I would never have predicted that.
Wow.
If somebody told me about, you know, the first run 6 weeks after having a child that I'd pee my pants within 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But it was a 5 minute kilometer. I was happy with the pace. You know?
Oh, that's great. I mean, that's a great pace. That's a great pace.
I'm not doing that right now. But so I'm trying to set
I tell you,
goals.
Some of us moms can relate to the pee in your pants, but we can't relate to that time. We can't relate to that pace at all.
So you kind of take it as it goes.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to find that balance,
yeah,
of being there and being at home and being a good mom, but still taking some time for myself.
Yes.
And I think I've struggled with that guilt sometimes. So I've now that Martin's a little bit older and he's on one nap and it tends to be longer, because at first he would do 20 minute naps constantly. So I usually play a video and I do a workout of whatever I need. Right now it's more mobility, but I do it right away. It doesn't matter if things are a mess. And then after that, he wakes up. I do get other things done.
Mm-hmm.
I do read books sometimes, but I put that first. And that's coming back to that idea of the checklist, and that's just my job, because I didn't do that at first. And then if I'm not happy and I'm not sleeping well, then it becomes a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
So then seasonally, if it's nice, I try to get him running in the stroller once or twice a week.
Yeah.
And then there's 2 mornings a week where I just get up super early and I go out, and Ian, my husband's home, and often he's not awake anyways,
yeah,
until I get back. But
yeah,
it's a lot easier to do that. So I'm focusing more on running, which was my first strength.
But how smart, and I think you really hit it on the head, for a lot of us in our regular lives now, to do it first. Even if, I loved what you said, do it first, even if there's a mess. I made it a priority, get it done when they're sleeping. And because we as moms, and we have many excuses and many reasons, good reasons. Well, we can't get that in. I only had this much time and I have to do all these things for my family. But you give us good cause and a good sort of method to get things in for ourselves. Now, I haven't heard in this whole conversation that, but you know, I'm going to stay fit and stuff, but I'm done with racing or I'm done internationally. Does that come into the picture? Do you not worry about that? Are you going to wait and see? What sort of does Chantel Givens in your amazing list of things to do? Is there still some racing on your list?
I can't really answer that question, because there definitely was at first. And even when I first started postpartum, I was really thinking, okay, which Beachbody program is going to get me kind of race ready. But now with everything that's happened with the pandemic, I'm thinking, you know what, maybe getting some of those times back and being able to do those mile intervals at the pace that I did, or kind of set different little goals. And in some ways, when the racing journey came to me, it was just things happen and an opportunity arose and I seized it. So I think at this point I'm not looking for the opportunities,
yep,
but I'm not closed to them either.
Nice.
And that's probably the best way to describe it. Whereas when I was diving, when I was done, that was a chapter closed.
Yeah.
But there's different forms of racing. You know, there are runs.
Mm-hmm.
There's, with triathlon, it's also outside. There's different ways you can get a race in without it being paratriathlon. To hit some of those times and get a few paces, yes.
Well, it keeps that competitive side of you fulfilled a little bit, right?
So exactly.
I think that's important too, for people to hear that, you know, for you now being a mom to Martin, and even with the adversity of having him, and even without adversity, just that role is of ultimate importance, and we'll see where that takes you yet. So let's go to some of our rapid fire questions.
Sure.
Now, we're enjoying the outdoors here, just outside your beautiful home, and we're hearing a lot of sounds. Do you have a favorite sound, Chantel?
Well, it's funny because we did get the questions in advance, so I looked a little bit, and I would say my childhood favorite sound, I grew up in not a competitive sport family, but my dad was a sailor and we had a boat. And my favorite childhood calming sound was always the break of the ocean water on the hull. Right now, I would say it's probably more just playing around with Martin and some of his little laughs and his squeals.
What is something that you've struggled with that continues to affect you now that no one would know looking at you?
I'd say probably some of that guilty feeling. And I find it really important to take some time for myself, but I also really feel guilty if I feel I'm doing too much. It might look on the surface like I've got this down. You know, at nap time, I do my 20 to 40 minute workout, then I do stuff, I get the house clean, I get supper done. But some, I still struggle with where that balance should tip to. I'd say that's probably just tweaking that balance and letting go of the guilt of figuring it out.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're speaking to the heart of moms everywhere. Yeah. And that balance, and are we doing enough? And I would venture to say that you are, but it's nice to know that you too have struggles. And I think that's where this question really sort of has a good place in our chat. Mm-hmm. Describe an ordinary moment.
An ordinary moment? That's a good question. I'll say I couldn't totally prepare for that. I would say probably the most ordinary moments are when plans change at the last second. I go out to the park, run into someone I haven't seen in a while.
Aww.
Or we plan to go out and, oh, there's a diaper change. Or something else. It just seems that plans are changing all the time. And if there's anything that motherhood has taught me is I used to be very much, I had that checklist. Mm-hmm. And I just do things as my job. When I'd start something, I'd be very single track to, okay, if I'm starting dinner, I'm going to finish dinner. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it's like, I might start something and, oh, there's a wake up and it's an hour earlier than I thought it would be. So I think an ordinary moment for me right now is just learning how to be okay with doing what I can at the moment and it'll come.
What is one piece of advice you want to pass along to others?
I would say that one of them is that dreaming and having dreams is super important. I know that in a lot of ways, it's definitely made me who I am. But I also think that if there's any advice I can give is to be open, to be adaptable. And if I had stuck to my guns as a 15-year-old and I want to go to the Olympics and diving, it's like, honestly, that natural talent factor wasn't there and I could have killed myself trying. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean it's not okay to dream. And sure, when another opportunity came where I was able to invest 100%. So I think that you have to kind of accept the cards you're dealt and really use dreams as making the most of you as who you are.
What is a quote you love?
Probably one from my dad, which he told me growing up. And my dad passed away just before I was on the team, so he doesn't know about the Paralympics. He never got to meet my son. But he used to tell me all the time growing up that the harder you work for something, the more you appreciate it.
What is your favorite failure?
Well, in a crazy way, it probably is falling down and breaking that shoulder blade, because I've made a fabulous friend that I really bonded with because that happened. And it took me around the world to try to get those points and make it to Rio.
Yeah.
And I had incredible experiences there. Like failure in Australia and not getting what I wanted, to the point where, you know, my team wasn't even talking to me that night because I didn't do my job.
Yeah.
To then being told, okay, well, you have to go to Spain in 3 weeks. And getting it together and going with my strength coach. And he had a very different approach. And then that was probably the highlight of my career. And I won that race. And part of that was because I dealt with that failure. It wasn't expected. This is just what I have to do to mm-hmm. get to my goal. And so probably if I hadn't have had that accident, I would have not learned the wisdom that I did from those other races, and I wouldn't have made a great friend. So.
Tell us about a book that you would recommend and why.
Well, when I was training, I didn't read very much. Life was chaotic, but I did have a couple of training camps in Victoria where suddenly I don't have family obligations, dog, it's just train, rest. And I read Silken Lahman's book, Unsinkable. Mm-hmm. And Silken Lahman, Olympic rower.
Amazing.
Truly amazing, inspirational person. And I was really enjoying the book because I knew of a few of the challenges she had faced, but I didn't know about a lot of the details. And she overcame physical, she overcame emotional, like incredible challenges, and yet she still accomplished her goals. And I was really inspired reading her book, and she now lives in Victoria. And when I'm at this camp, I was totally engrossed in this book. And the next morning at swim practice, there's Silken Lahman in the next lane. I got to meet her in person. I'm reading your book.
How cool.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't come along with most of the recommended books that we talk about around here.
No.
Fantastic. Hey, do you have a few songs that you love?
Yes and no. I don't listen to music all the time. I know some people are always plugged in. And when I'm training, not always. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't really run to music. I like to take things in.
Yep.
One song that is close to my heart, and I think a lot of times songs are related to experience, mm-hmm. but one of them would be Budapest by George Ezra. And that song was actually playing on the radio the day that I made the commitment to reduce my time at work. And in my mind, that was really this shift where this training wasn't just a side thing. The training was now becoming that central focus of mm-hmm. balance. And that song has parts of it where it's talking about good reasons for not changing and wanting to change. So that song, if I hear it, I really have, it's close to my heart.
Who are two or three people who've influenced you, and how did they impact your life?
Okay, I would definitely say my dad. Well, both of my parents definitely, but just the attitude and the outlook of going and coming from people that didn't understand competitive sports, they were not hockey watchers, but just being there and supporting and still giving me that competitive instinct and supporting everything that I did.
Yeah.
And when my dad was always telling me to appreciate things when you work hard, that was definitely probably number one. It actually wasn't until I was almost 40 years old at the fertility clinic that I actually found out what happened to my hand. And I was waiting in line and the gynecologist came in and he looked at me, and I was actually watching the Winter Paralympics on my phone waiting for the appointment. And he looked at me and he looked at the circulation and he said, "Do you know what happened?" And I said, "No." He said, "You had a blood clot at 7 weeks gestation." And that was kind of huge for me because I'd never worried about it.
Yeah.
But finding out from the least likely person, and he wasn't actually my assigned doctor, he was there that day. But if I talk about influential person, if there was someone I would thank is Dr. McTavish, because that just gave me that whew. Because when you worry and things aren't going well, is it something with me? Is it something I'm passing on? And that just kind of gave me that peace of mind. And he didn't say it in a nasty way, like mm-hmm. he held out a hand and helped me off the table after. So that was an interesting thing at 39 and 3/4 years that
wow.
I found out.
Yeah. And it gave you some closure and a reason.
Exactly.
And then you could move forward.
Yeah. Another person whom I haven't seen in over 20 years, his name is John Hogg, and he's a sports psychologist who was in Edmonton. I'm honestly not sure if he's still alive. But he had come to do a guest talk to our diving team the first couple of months I was diving. And not coming from a family of competitive sports, it was his speech that taught me what having a sport dream can be. And he was talking about wanting to go far and visualizing and having goals and setting them. And just that talk, I ended up going back to see him in university a few times and taking some of his courses. I was in molecular biology and I'm taking sports psychology because that just opened a new door to me. If he ever hears this, thank you, John.
Well, you know, I don't think our lives go the way they go without certain people being our heroes as well. So, mm-hmm. Chantal, thank you for your story. You were world class. You were an international competitor. And yet you've shared with us your heart of balancing that and all that you learned in the adversity into your regular life. And the little bit of adversity that some might say you were born with. And it never stood in your way. And now you continue to rise above. And you truly are a hero in our midst. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.